I can do things financially that would be very bad for Russia.
We will have our differences, but we will have to find common avenues.
We're looking to build a coalition of the willing from Europe and beyond.
The president won't even take the prime minister's call.
Hello, welcome to the very first, the inaugural episode of World News Weekly. Every week, we'll take you beyond the headlines to unpack the biggest stories shaping Australia and the world. I'm Katrina Stirrett, and joining me today is SBS World News journalist Claudia Farhart. Hi, Claudia.
Hi, Kat. We got a bit to talk about today.
Yes, but despite all the global turmoil, the Pope is still hanging in there.
Yeah, he's on the mend. Could be out of hospital soon, apparently. But he would be coming out into a very different world than the one he left a month ago, and that's largely thanks to our friend in Washington, Donald Trump.
Indeed, episode one, and straight off the bat, so much to dive into. There's plenty we could talk about, but today we'll be unpacking the latest Ukraine peace talks and hopes for a temporary ceasefire, implications following the United States' global tariffs, the impacts we're already starting to witness following a huge purge of USAID, and turning to Syria, where we're seeing the first outbreak of violence since the fall of Assad's regime.
But before we get onto all of that, a couple of quick things to tell you about first. In the Philippines, former President Rodrigo Duterte has been arrested by Philippines National Police on allegations he oversaw death squads in his bloody war on drugs. That was the signature policy of his presidency, that brutal crackdown that human rights groups estimate saw as many as 30,000 civilians killed. Many of them, Kat, were small-time drug dealers and users, and they never faced trial. Duterte will now, though, over his part in all of this. He's currently being held in The Hague, where he'll face charges at the ICC of crimes against humanity.
Definitely one to monitor. And then, of course, all the way over in Greenland, with its very small population of just 57,000, the centre-right Democratic Party, led by former badminton player Jens Fredrik Nielsen, has won after early parliamentary elections were called. The party, which actually favours gradual independence from Denmark, more than tripled their seats to 10 in the 31-seat parliament, so quite significant. And of course, it's important to note Nielsen is the same leader who firmly told Trump, "We are not for sale," after the US president insisted the island was essential to US security and would eventually form part of the states.
And just a quick update for you on the war in the Middle East. Negotiations between Israel and Hamas restarted this week in Doha in an attempt to salvage their ceasefire and hostage deal. The first phase ended on March 1 with no agreement between the two on how to proceed, and it sounds like they still can't agree, Kat. Israel wants to extend the first phase. Hamas wants to proceed to the second, where they'd negotiate a permanent end to the war in exchange for all the remaining living hostages. Israel's been upping the pressure on them in the meantime, blocking all aid deliveries into Gaza and then cutting off the last of the electricity supply to the Strip as well.
And in any other time, we would probably be delving right into those headlines, but times are certainly unique. So let's unpack some of those bigger stories we flagged at the beginning, and starting with Ukraine now. Now, a meeting between delegations from Kyiv and Washington in Saudi Arabia on Tuesday ended in an agreement between Ukraine and the US to enact a 30-day temporary pause in fighting between Russia and Ukraine for a conflict that's been going on since 2014. Essentially, the United States, including Trump and Secretary of State Marco Rubio, have really put the ball in Russia's court now. We have since heard from President Vladimir Putin, who is currently visiting Russia's Kursk region for the first time since Ukrainian forces seized it. But he is a little from Trump earlier.
In a financial sense, yeah, we could do things very bad for Russia. It would be devastating for Russia, but I don't want to do that because I want to see peace. And we're getting close to maybe getting something done. We've got Ukraine done. And as you know, I've always said that Ukraine might have been the more difficult party. You were here a week ago when some interesting things happened. I had somebody that didn't seem to want peace. Now he's agreed to peace.
So really the first time there we've heard Trump put the pressure on Russia rather than Ukraine.
So what do we know so far about this ceasefire proposal, Claudia?
So Washington released a statement after these talks in Saudi. They said that Ukraine had agreed to an immediate 30-day pause in all fighting, not just fighting by air and sea, which had previously been flagged, so land as well. They said that this deal would include things like prisoner swaps and the return of forcibly detained Ukrainian children who've been held in Russia throughout this war. They didn't say anything in the official statement about security guarantees for Ukraine, though. Zelensky later said those would be agreed at a later time, and some of his aides have told the media that they did discuss them, but that has been a sticking point in reaching a deal previously, so we need to watch what happens there. More immediately for Kyiv, though, by accepting this initial proposal from Washington, it's also managed to undo that US pause on military aid and intelligence sharing, both of which were hugely worrying for Kyiv. You know, things like being able to track Russian troop movements and just keep the supply of weapons to their troops on the front lines. So that is maybe the biggest immediate win for Ukraine out of this. And the US and Ukraine also said that they would conclude the minerals deal as soon as possible. That's the deal Trump had demanded as some form of compensation, I guess, for the US military support over the last 3 years that would give the US long-term access to Ukraine's rare earth minerals. All of this is a, I guess, much-needed turning point after that disastrous White House meeting we saw a couple of weeks ago that ended with Zelensky being kicked out of the White House. Trump now says he'd be welcomed back after agreeing to this. So a lot's happened in 2 weeks. There's still a lot we don't know, though. How this ceasefire would be enforced, how Ukraine's security would be guaranteed, and the status of the regions Russia has occupied and annexed during this war. Also still up for debate is Ukraine's future ambitions to join NATO and the EU, you know, things that all sort of conversations that were happening at the start of this war. These have all been sticking points in the past, so we're going to see if they will be again.
Absolutely. And obviously it's early days, but there are some positive signs for Ukraine there. But what about the rest of Europe? How are they responding? Because, of course, we did see talks also play out in Paris between Ukraine and European delegates.
Yeah, those talks were interesting. More than 30 army chiefs from NATO countries, from the EU, as well as from here in Australia, New Zealand, Japan, met in Paris on Tuesday without the US to discuss what sort of concrete security guarantees Ukraine would need in the event that this ceasefire does come to fruition. It's probably the first time Washington has been excluded from these kinds of talks. Those present say that they want to send a pretty clear message that Europe can do this with or without Washington's help, but that Europe can stand on its own 2 feet when it comes to defending Ukraine's security and sovereignty. These talks all part of the Coalition of the Willing that Keir Starmer and Emmanuel Macron are taking the lead on, the European-led force that would be set up to enforce any ceasefire deal, the one that here in Australia, PM Anthony Albanese says that we would be a part of as well. But to make that possible, there needs to be a massive boost in European defence spending, which is ironically what Trump wanted all along. So we're now seeing that play out. In the EU, Ursula von der Leyen unveiled a $1.38 trillion plan to do that this week. We've also gotten Paris talks from Europe's five biggest military powers, being France, Britain, Germany, Italy and Poland, on the necessary rearmament of Europe, what they're calling the necessary rearmament of Europe. There's broad consensus that this needs to happen, but there's already been significant issues getting it there. So Germany's incoming chancellor wants to free up hundreds of billions of euros for defence spending by making defence exempt from the country's debt break borrowing limits set out in its constitution, but some of the opposition parties are already blocking that. So there could be issues like that across the continent pop up in actually making this boost in defence spending actually happen.
Yeah, so clearly desperate attempts to end this conflict, but certainly lots of negotiations ongoing.
I always say tariffs is the most beautiful word to me in the dictionary. Then I was reprimanded by the fake news. They said, what about love, religion, and God? I said, I agree. Let's put God number one. Let's put religion number two. Love, I don't know. We got to put that number three, I guess, right? And then it's tariff.
So I don't think I need to introduce who that was speaking there, but turning from diplomatic efforts to diplomatic tensions, countries are continuing to retaliate against the United States tariffs, the latest of which was a 25% tariff on all steel and aluminium imported into the US, and that, of course, applies to all countries. I think it's important to preface, though, off the bat what a tariff actually is, and that is a tax paid when goods are sent from one country to another. So initially, the US imposed 25% tariffs on all products from Canada and Mexico coming into the US, and China 20% earlier this month. That's now been delayed for Canada and Mexico to April the 2nd if they comply with the US-Mexico-Canada Free Trade Agreement. Since then, Canada has hit back with an additional $32.8 billion in retaliatory tariffs. China has announced tariffs of 10 to 15% on numerous US agricultural goods, while the EU has announced it would levy $45 billion in tariffs against US industries in response to Trump's tariffs on metal imports. But even Australia is not immune. After hoping for an exemption on those sweeping aluminium and steel tariffs, Trump confirmed the tariffs would in fact proceed against Australia. So, Claudia, at this stage, what does it look like the effects of all this are going to be?
Still early days, Kat. Trump says it's going to boost the US's metals sector and create jobs by making foreign products less attractive. But most economists think US consumers will probably just have the costs passed on to them. So that means anything from cars to soft drinks, anything using these metals will become more expensive. So far as well around the world, it's stoked fears of another global economic slowdown. It's spooked markets around the globe, which have been jumping all over the place this week as a result. Shares in car makers in particular have taken a pretty hefty hit. This is how one analyst, David Frum, who's a political commentator and used to be a speechwriter for the former President George W. Bush, put it.
The idea of advanced industrial products with thousands of components and subcomponents, and each of those components crossing a NAFTA border five or six times over the course of its career from beginning to end, with a tariff at every transfer. That's not the way Donald Trump understands the world economy. He's a man of the 1970s. He thinks in terms of toasters. He thinks in terms of cars. He doesn't understand how the modern economy works, how modern supply chains work, and how destructive all of this is. But the stock market gets it, and the stock market is reacting with panic.
So still early days, Kat, but already seeing some effects on stock markets around the world. Also interesting effects in Canada. Obviously, there's been these tariff threats going back and forth across the border, but also annexation threats, you know, Trump threatening to make Canada the, quote, 51st state of the US. And that's all of that together has seen the ruling Liberal parties start to surge in the polls. I mean, a few months ago, when Justin Trudeau, the Prime Minister, announced he'd be stepping down, the Conservatives, their rivals, looked pretty sure to win the next election. They'd been focusing on similar issues that we're talking about here, things like cost of living and housing affordability. Now, with tariffs and with talks of annexation, regardless of how realistic or unrealistic that actually is, none of that really matters to voters anymore. The number one issue has suddenly become Canada's security. I mean, both their sovereignty in terms of, you know, maintaining sovereignty with threats of annexation, but also economically, three quarters of Canadian exports are bound for the US. So you can't really overstate the significance those tariffs will have for the economy. The new PM, Mark Carney, took over this week, and with the party now surging in the polls, he could really call an election at any point. I mean, they have to by October, but with his party surging in the polls, a snap one could be called any minute now.
Yeah, so clearly having ramifications beyond trade. But how's the rest of the world reacting to these tariffs? Because it appears Australia's reaction differs from others as well.
Yeah, I think everyone's scrambling just to work out what the right way to respond to this is, much as they do with everything these days with Trump. Some are fighting back with retaliatory tariffs. So the EU's announced counter tariffs on almost $50 billion worth of US goods. That includes industrial products like, you know, steel and aluminium, but also on US agricultural products and even Harley-Davidson motorbikes. These mostly are products that come from red states, Republican states, so it's a pretty deliberate message that they're trying to send in Trump heartland. Others are trying to appease the US in hopes of getting an exemption, like the UK and Australia, so far to no avail, though.
And for deeper analysis on all of this, we're joined by our chief political correspondent, Anna Henderson, who's been watching these developments very closely from Canberra. Hi, Anna. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And before we delve into your analysis on all of this, Anna, we've actually got a bit of a taste of how the PM responded to this issue.
Tariffs and escalating trade tensions are a form of economic self-harm and a recipe for slower growth and higher inflation. They are paid by the consumers. This is why Australia will not be imposing reciprocal tariffs on the United States. Such a course of action would only push up prices for Australian consumers and increase inflation.
And the opposition leader, Peter Dutton, came back a lot stronger on this, and here's a bit of what he had to say.
It's obvious that Anthony Albanese and Kevin Rudd have had a shocker. The Prime Minister can't secure a phone call, let alone a meeting with the President of the United States. And how on earth can an outcome be negotiated if the President won't even take the Prime Minister's call? So it's not just Australians who see the Prime Minister as weak and incompetent. It's our trading partners as well.
So, Anna, can you tell us, how has Canberra responded to this failure to secure an exemption on tariffs?
Well, it wasn't a shock here in Canberra, but it certainly was a bitter pill for the government. The Prime Minister has largely resisted directly criticising the President until now, but he really amped up his rhetoric when this decision was announced. He says the tariffs were unjustified and unfriendly. He's questioned the economics of the decision. No country got an exemption, and that's been underscored. And for some perspective, our exports of steel and aluminium to the US make up just 0.2% of our export market if you look at last year. So the direct industry impact has been described as minimal. But look at the charm offensive that the government tried to put on here. Penny Wong went to Washington, D.C., the foreign minister. The Treasurer, Jim Chalmers, was also there. The Deputy Prime Minister and Defence Minister, Richard Miles, showed up on Capitol Hill with an $800 million down payment on the AUKUS submarine deal. So there were attempts to try and convince the Trump administration to give Australia an exemption. The opposition has been saying that the Prime Minister should have boarded a plane himself. I'm told by diplomatic kind of hardheads here in Canberra that realistically that wouldn't have really changed the mind of Donald Trump. But we have a situation now where the Prime Minister, while he has spoken to Donald Trump on the phone twice previously, is unable to get a direct line of communication with the President now. And it's delivered the opposition leader in Peter Dutton a chance to claim he could have done a deal and to continue with that narrative that the Prime Minister is weak on the world stage.
And Anna, we've always sort of considered ourselves to have a special kind of friendship with the US. What's all of this mean for Australians and for our relationship with Washington going forward?
Yeah, a mateship and also a free trade agreement. As one political insider put to me, the intent behind this decision from the Trump administration effectively shreds the idea of free trade between the two nations. So it's raised a real sense of foreboding about other lucrative export industries, pharmaceuticals and agriculture, and whether or not they could face tariffs as we lead up to sort of an April deadline on that front. And the US is Australia's closest security and intelligence ally, and the strength of that alliance is now being really questioned. And we have to be careful not to exaggerate that, but there's this lack of trust that appears to be developing now. And one interesting note at this point, while Anthony Albanese and Donald Trump have spoken on the phone now twice, they've never actually met before. So we kind of end the political term with an election looming. The Albanese government did manage to unpick kind of billions in trade sanctions imposed by Beijing after being elected. But now we end the term with economic pressure coming from our closest international ally.
Very interesting times ahead. Anna Henderson, our chief political correspondent, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
So let's take a quick breather now, and we'll return after the break with more out of the US and the Trump administration's move to cut foreign aid. What are the tangible consequences? We've got some stats that will certainly surprise you. So more moves out of the United States now. It's truly the gift that keeps on giving. Since Trump came to power, he pledged a freeze in foreign aid as part of a war on, quote, government waste, led alongside his ally and billionaire Elon Musk. He signed an executive order on January 20, citing that much foreign assistance was wasteful. A review soon turned into a purging of aid programs from its six-decade U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID, which first began under President John F. Kennedy all the way back in 1961 during that Cold War era. Now, it's important to note the US actually accounts for more than 40% of all humanitarian aid globally, the single largest aid donor in the world. Secretary of State Marco Rubio has since declared this termination of aid assistance has already resulted in the US cutting 83% of humanitarian and development programs abroad, pulling all but a few hundred staffers off the job and shutting down the agency's Washington headquarters. There's also been reports of staff being called to shred documents, with a union coming back for a federal judge to intervene. And of course, as I mentioned, tens of thousands of aid workers have been laid off, many stranded overseas, awaiting back payments and travel expenses. So really fast-moving developments there. It's obviously been a little over 6 weeks since the foreign aid freeze began. So, Claudia, what kind of impacts are we seeing so far?
We're really seeing the global aid system begin to unravel. I mean, we're talking about 5,200 out of 6,200 projects that have now been cut the remaining 1,000 apparently are going to be absorbed by the State Department. They won't be administered by USAID anymore. The Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, said they, quote, spent tens of billions of dollars in ways that did not serve and in some cases even harmed the core national interests of the United States. Some of the projects he's talking about, providing water and sanitation and waste management in Syria's refugee camps, that work stopped. Hospitals in Thailand that have been treating 100,000 refugees from Myanmar, they've now been forced to either cut back their services or stop work altogether. Food assistance programs for malnutritioned kids in several countries like Congo, Nigeria, Sudan, Afghanistan, so many more, are all facing shutdown. This is the type of work that's being dismissed by the administration as a waste of money. And even projects administering life-saving aid, which Rubio originally sort of implied might be exempt from all of this, have now been cut. The acting assistant administrator of USAID, Nicholas Enric, put this into some perspective for us this week in a memo that was leaked to the press. He said if these cuts aren't reversed, we'll see hundreds of millions of people get polio in the next decade. That's preventable. And 200,000 people will be paralysed by it. He said almost 18 million people will get malaria and as many as 166,000 will die from it, and tuberculosis cases will soar by 30%. I wanted to talk to you about tuberculosis because there have been some very strong warnings about this one in particular from the international community this week and what's going to happen in this space as a result of this aid shutdown. The doctors who lead the Stop TB Partnership, so that's a UN network that it sort of leads the fight against this disease, and now warning dangerous new strains of tuberculosis could emerge as a result of these cuts, because by stopping people's treatment, you allow this thing to mutate into new and different forms, and they could be forms that we can't actually treat with medicine. The World Health Organization pointed out that when treatment was interrupted a few years ago during the COVID-19 pandemic, there were 700,000 excess deaths from tuberculosis over 3 years. So that gives you an idea of what disrupting this treatment does. In the past 2 decades, they say tuberculosis prevention work has saved more than 79 million lives.
Wow.
But any disruption to that work can have devastating effects. That's just one disease, Kat. There are hundreds of healthcare programs and millions of the world's most vulnerable people who depend on them now staring down this kind of uncertainty as a result of those cuts.
God, some really staggering statistics there. And as you mentioned, we've just come out of a global pandemic as well. So very frightening for those who are really relying on humanitarian assistance at
Absolutely.
The moment. Turning to the Middle East now, and it's been 3 months since Bashar al-Assad's regime fell in Syria, and we've witnessed the first major outbreak of violence since then, with more than 1,000 people killed so far.
Yeah, most of the violence we've been seeing, Kat, has been on Syria's coastline around the cities of Latakia and Tartus. That is formerly Assad heartland, also home to the Alawites, a minority sect of Shia Islam that the Assad family is part of. This all began late last week when armed Assad loyalists ambushed security forces of the new government, killing more than 20 people. The government immediately sent thousands of reinforcements to the region to crack down on any potential uprising that the Assad loyalists were planning. But what happened next, Kat, was some of the worst communal violence Syria has seen in recent years. There have been reports that killing squads rampage through these coastal provinces home to the Alawites, and according to the UK-based Syrian Observatory for Human Rights, killed more than 1,000 civilians, not armed fighters, civilians. The UN says in some cases, entire families were slaughtered in this violence. There's no evidence so far that it was HTS or al-Shara who actually ordered this. We know other armed groups got in on the violence too, other armed factions as well. But for thousands of Alawites, this has now sparked fears that this kind of communal violence everyone had hoped would be behind Syria will be back. Thousands have fled into neighbouring Lebanon in fear of their lives. And certainly along Syria's western coast, a really precarious situation right now.
What does this all mean for the new government led by al-Shara?
So the government's announced a fact-finding commission to investigate these killings. It says nobody's going to be above the law, although it appears that the new government's own forces were involved to some extent. Shara says other groups entered the region without their approval as well. In any case, how HTS handles this is going to have massive implications for its legitimacy internationally. It was already struggling with its image, with its roots as an al-Qaeda affiliate, and with its history throughout Syria's civil war. There have been huge huge efforts to reform that image and convince the international community that it can, in fact, lead this new Syria. It had early success doing that. It got some sanction relief from the EU, although the EU had warned them pretty clearly that if HDS took the wrong steps in governing Syria, that that sanction relief could be reversed. After all this violence at the weekend, they're desperately trying to get the situation back on track. They signed a deal to integrate the Kurdish-led Syrian Democratic Forces into the new government, a deal that HDS says will guarantee the rights of the Kurdish minority in Syria. So it's a big deal for the community that has been on the outer for so long. A major win for al-Shara too, who said he, when he took power, said he'd govern for all Syrians regardless of their religion or sect. The world will no doubt, though, now Kat, be watching to see if and how he can do the same for the Alawites in the wake of this devastating communal violence.
We'll be sure to return to this region over the next few weeks, an incredibly precarious situation, Claudia, but let's take a bit of a breather now and turn to something a little lighter. The Girl Scouts in the US are in a bit of hot water. We'll find out why after this short break.
Is this made from real lemons?
Yes.
I only like all natural foods and beverages, organically grown with no preservatives. I'll tell you what, I'll buy a cup if you buy a box of my delicious Girl Scout cookies. Do we have a deal?
Are they made from real Girl Scouts?
So that was a grab from the 1991 classic Addams Family movie, but it turns out we're still asking what's in those cookies and now possibly in court? Why are the Girl Scouts being sued, Claudia?
It's the cookies, Kat. A woman in New York has filed a proposed class action against the Girl Scouts of America and two baking companies over claims their famous cookies contain heavy metals. Specifically, according to the lawsuit, arsenic, lead, mercury, and aluminium.
Aluminium.
Wonder
very
if they'll
interesting.
Have tariffs slapped
I was gonna
on
say,
them.
Very interesting timing with that one.
As well as other pesticides, apparently. All of this is based on a study released last December of just 25 cookies, not exactly a large number. It wasn't published in any kind of academic journal. It wasn't peer reviewed, but there you go. The Girl Scouts say their cookies are safe. Scouts honor and all that.
I was going to say, can we trust them?
Yeah, and that these heavy metals allegedly detected occur naturally in the environment, meaning that, you know, anything can have trace amounts, but they're not necessarily harmful to consume. In any case, the lawsuit is seeking $5 million US dollars in damages. So you could buy a few cookies with that, I reckon, Kat.
Wow. So a bit of a public service announcement for any US listeners out there opening the door to any Girl Scouts.
That's it. That's what we're here for.
Well, that's The World this week. Be sure to subscribe to the World News weekly podcast. New episodes will drop every Friday. And as always, you can live stream the SBS World News Bulletin from 6:30 p.m. every night or anytime by going to SBS On Demand. Claudia, catch you next week.
Thanks, Kat. See you then.